are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Assistant Professor of History and Black Studies, Terrence Keel, on Divine Variations, How Christian Thought Became Racial Science. Also on the program today, federal judge rules the Trump administration must accept new DACA applications. Meanwhile, 9,000 Nepalis facing deportation as Trump cancels their residency permits. And poor Ronnie Jackson. Mick Mulvaney brings new meaning to pay to play. And to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Dems win big in special elections, flip 40 state house seats last night, and win big even when they lose in Arizona. Meanwhile, SCOTUS is looking at a Texas redistricting case. New study shows Trump voters fear loss of status more than they experience economic anxiety. And the Massachusetts Supreme Court affirms charters not the answer to weak public schools, but rather better public schools. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, it's Wednesday. And not an enormous amount, you know. I don't know. I have no way of gauging now how much news is actually happening on any given day. I feel like I'm completely, I've lost my, people have their inner clock. I've lost my inner news measurement. I can't even determine. Was someone arrested last night? Was there a no-knock warrant served, or did Donald Trump start nuclear war with somebody? I know that he made out with Macron for a long time.
Not quite my daughter, but
not my. There's something super weird about that relationship, but we'll talk more about it later. But I can assure you that Macron has about one thing on his mind, and that is how many books he's going to sell when this is all over.
To be fair, every relationship I'm a part of is super weird.
It's true. This one, though, I think Macron is going to, he's just, all he's doing now, it just feels like he's just trying to get like another chapter out of it. Like right now, he's just sitting to his publisher. It's like, I've got one, but I want deux.
I have three goals. One is to destroy labor movement, make of France a neoliberal hellscape. Two is to recolonize Africa. And three is to have the most weird interactions with the Donald Trump as possible so that I can write about this.
I think he's going for two chapters now. Like he's going to maybe like even three. Like we have to have three. Like, because I feel like
his
he could
hand
write,
grazed my penis and then he told me that my wife was a total babe for an ancient woman and that it was really true. And then we all looked into space awkwardly and then his wife sent me a note that just said, please help. So this is all very strange.
Right. She just sits, Melania sits across the table and blinks out SOS. So it looks like Pompeo heading to the Senate, well, is heading to the Senate and heading to confirmation. The next big question mark is going to be the whether or not we will have a torturer as the head of the CIA. That won't come up in front of the Senate for another week or two. But meanwhile, poor Ronnie Jackson. I'm really starting to feel bad for this guy. because he thought he was going to get a nice gig in and I really do think this, that the VA is the single most complicated agency in the United States government. It has about 375, I think it is, maybe 400,000 employees. Essentially 9 million customers. They provide services that range, that are across the board. Across the board in terms of services, not just healthcare, but and not just in, you know, sort of insurance and mechanisms to pay for it, but services across the board. And on top of that, the medical services they provide are completely unique. They are not replicated to a large extent in the general public. And to the extent that they are, they emanate out of the VA because you're dealing with a clientele that have suffered very specific types of injuries and contract specific illnesses because of their time in war. It is incredibly complicated. The number of people that Jackson would oversee, as opposed to, you know, specifically administratively, I don't even know what is a factor of what. I mean, 60,000 more? I mean, times the number of people that he's managing now. It's incredibly complicated job. He apparently has no, I mean, he's a rear admiral, but the in terms of like actual executive and administrative functioning, there's no resume there. But for whatever reason, in our system of government, that can't be questioned. Or that's not questioned, and that's not a legitimate question. It's got to focus on his personal behavior, which apparently is not terribly above reproach for someone in his position. Here is John Tester on Anderson Cooper last night explaining.
It's you know, these are called controlled substances for a reason. We have...
So he would actually just go down the aisle and
yes,
just sort of say,
that's correct.
Who wants to go to sleep, who wants to wake up?
That's the reports we got from the people, the 20-some people who got a hold of us and said, we've got a problem, this doctor has a problem, because
now,
he hands...
Now, so they're talking about, apparently, on these trips, that he would hand out Ambien and hand out a another drug, I think it's Mendafol, I can't remember exactly what it is. That would wake you up. Now, my understanding is, I mean, as someone who takes Ambien, and I get it prescribed from a distance at this point, this doesn't seem to me to be that huge of an offense. Apparently, in the military, they hand out that Mendafol like it's...
Its brand name is Provigil, right?
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, okay, he's doing that. I'm not sure what bearing it has. You know, you get these doctors who work on productions and it's just like, how you feeling? Great. Okay. Terrific. Here's your, I mean, this doesn't seem to be that much of an offense, but
Randy,
they're making it,
they're
making hay. And then there's the other issue of the drinking on the job, which I think is a little bit more problematic.
He always keeps you up and never lets you down.
He's got a nickname, which is Fatal.
All right, good.
Because he hands out prescriptions like candy. In fact, in the White House, they call him the Candy Man.
So I just want to be clear, Ambien is actually one of the drugs?
I can get you the, okay. It's a drug, it's a prescription drug, and I can get you the
name. Your staff had told us Ambien,
right.
And yep. Provigil.
Bingo.
Okay.
Those are the ones.
All yep. Right. And I understand he had a nickname in the White House,
yeah,
among it, some
yep.
of the White House staff.
And it was the Candy Man, because he handed out prescription drugs like they were candy.
Yeah. And the other issues are that he apparently was drunk on the job. Now, he claims he never drank while on duty, but it sort of sounds like maybe he was still drunk while on duty from the night before, which is, you know, a little problematic when you're supposed to be protecting the health of a really important person. Like, I mean, I think I would have issues if Matt came in more drunk than he does now. And he's just working the soundboard. But
uppers and downers.
But here's the point. Here's the broader, you know, the broader issue. And there was, I mean, this is just another person who is highly unqualified. If you make an assessment of competency based upon what many of us assume most people want out of their government, which is it to function well and to function as a common good. But the bottom line is that Trump will put in a guy like Jackson because he likes them, and Trump is simple-minded, and he thinks he's a good guy, even though he's basically inviting him yesterday to quit. And then when he saw him in person and Jackson didn't offer to quit the nomination, Trump was like, good, you shouldn't, because he's too afraid to actually say it to his face. The bottom line is, this is not a coincidence that we have what we would traditionally call incompetent people in these positions, because the idea of the Trump administration primary objective being to deconstruct the administrative state is still operable. And we see it in every single department. We'll talk about it with Mick Mulvaney later in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You see it in the DOJ. They stop issuing consent decrees. They stop monitoring police departments. They stop pursuing a whole host of things, except for, of course, the sanctuary city stuff. You see it in virtually every single agency. Their PPO, their Presidential Personnel Office, is a joke because they don't care. They just want a conduit. And this is what I said last night on MSNBC. But we don't have it. So
this is the point I was trying to make about Betsy DeVos, too. Like, it's not same. That she's incompetent at her job. It's that her job is to destroy public education, and she can't say that out loud.
Yes. We all have an assumption about what competence is in these positions, and we're operating on a different plane of existence than they are. They measure competence by how quickly can you transfer public dollars into the private sphere. You see it with HUD. You see it in every single agency, and agencies that we can't even see. And so, you know, it's true. Donald Trump is a moron when it comes to personnel. Like, and because he is, he himself is so rotted inside and lacking integrity, that's who he attracts around him.
What?
I mean, you have a guy, this is funny, Kris Kobach. Apparently, in his lawsuit,
yes, this is
to,
great.
In his lawsuit, where he is being charged with, and he's already been admonished by multiple courts for suppressing votes. There's one argument that they try and make in a brief that was submitted to the federal court. And it was they're making arguments as to why the case should be dismissed, I believe. Yep. And argument number four, I don't know what paragraph this is, but this is document 522. Plaintiffs Fish, Bucci, and the League of Women Voters lack standing. But it's not a statement. It's a question mark. And then in caps, probably not worth arguing, question mark. I mean, this is the quality of legal work that you are getting from the Secretary of State, who is trying to defend disenfranchising voters, and they forget to take out the part like, this is so ridiculous. It might be a detriment to us to argue it because it's so laughable. It's not worth arguing. They resubmitted it. They resubmitted it, and took out those lines.
That's like when you hand in like a paper in college, and you're like sleep deprived in finals, and you realize like in the middle, you put in parentheses just like, you know, a string of curse words, and then if your professor's nice, they're like, "You want to hand in a different version of this?"
I mean,
like, yeah,
it's a joke.
But
it's
this
a
is
joke.
Like actually a.
But it's because
the equivalent of I'm trying to disenfranchise millions of voters.
They're not assessed on the same, you know, so-called merit system that we would assess other people working in government. They're assessed on their ability to extract. And if you think this is new with Trump, Google Grover Norquist and shrinking government to a size where you could drown it in the bathtub. This is the long-term Republican conservative agenda, and it just so happens they found the right boob to carry it out. All right, we got to take.
Nice.
We got to take
Ivanka boobs.
We got to take a break. We got to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to an assistant professor of. Associate professor of history and black studies at the University of California on his book, Divine Variations, How Christian Thought Became Racial Science. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Terrence Keel. He's an associate professor of history and black studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of Divine Variations, How Christian Thought Became Racial Science. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here.
So the thesis of your book centers around where, there's sort of almost two dual tracks here. One, more specifically, where our notions of the science behind race comes from, and more broadly speaking, where our notions of science or some of the basic assumptions, I guess, that we have. Scientific assumptions come from culture, but let's start with where the where our current day. Well, how about this? What is our current day assumptions about race from a scientific perspective?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me start with where you started, which is thinking about where. What is science, really? And that's part of what the book is doing. And then if we start there, then I can talk about race.
Sure.
So science, you know, is a human practice. And what I mean by that is it's conducted by humans who embody certain ideas and values and beliefs. And it's important to recognize this, and this is something that historians and social scientists who have been studying science for the last several decades have realized that when we think about science, we have to realize that scientists carry with them the past. They carry belief and ideas that shape the way they interpret data, shape the questions that they raise. But most importantly, science involves certain forms of belief, right? So if you're a researcher and you're interested in trying to explain why humans might vary genetically, for example. And you want to look for genetic traits that explain that variation. To do that work first involves the belief that, one, humans can be divided in such a way that race tracks on to genetic variation. Now, we often don't talk about scientific research in this way. We often talk in terms of scientists are merely discovering a gene for X, or they're merely discovering a biological mechanism that might explain racial variation. But what I'm doing in this book is trying to slow the process down and get us to think that, well, discovery first involves belief on behalf of the person who's raising the question. And that belief involves very basic things like the natural world is designed in such a way that with the right forms of inquiry, we can understand how that world is put together. And when it comes to humans, a similar type of process is at work.
Professor, let me just stop you there because I know I already can see the calls I'm going to get from scientists who listen to our program, and they're going to berate me. And I know, and they're gonna say that is actually not the way that one would investigate that question. That the question would be more specific. That they would have a thesis that they want to test, which is there a variation or something to that effect? Like that good science. And I'm not a scientist, but that good science starts with the whole idea of we're just going to test a thesis, and mm-hmm. I'm just grabbing theses that are out there. I mean, obviously, the thesis I want to test comes from who I am as a human being, but the thesis itself should not have any assumptions built into it itself. It should be testable.
Yeah, well, that's science in its ideal form, but science in its practice is a very different thing. And I think when it comes to the scientific studies of race, there is a very long, clear, established history of bad scientific thinking when researchers get in the business of trying to understand race. And let me explain. If you think about what happens to population genetics and human biology after what's called the modern synthesis, which happens in the 1950s, when geneticists like Theodosius Dobzhansky and others begin to realize that you can begin to look at massive human population evolution at a macro level and correlate that with sort of individual or micro level human adaptation and be able to understand that the evolutionary model articulated by Darwin gives us a lens to actually think about the evolution of our species as well as other organisms in sort of a grand sense. But what's interesting is that what is also clear among scientists in the 1950s as well, and this is articulated in the UNESCO Statements on Race, race is not a very clear concept. It is something that what geneticists are beginning to realize, there are no genes for race as we now know it. There's not a single genetic trait that sort of explains racial diversity, right? And you get social scientists who begin to question the connections that we make between race and intelligence, race and IQ, race and sort of physical ability. These things begin to break down in the 1950s, and these are breaking down by scientists themselves. They're beginning to realize that we actually can't find race in the kind of clear ways that scientists imagined in the 19th century, for example. Fast forward to 2000, when we get the sequencing of the human genome, and we begin to realize that humans are 99.98% the same. This has a huge effect on the way we think about race, and it's very clear that genetically there are no genes for race, right? And that this is something that is supported by biologists across the field, and begin to realize that, again, like in the 1950s, there really is not a sound reason to look for race within our biology. And the reason why I'm stressing this is that despite these scientific breakthroughs, which were done by scientists who were doing proper sort of thesis and testing them in the lab, scientists continue to ignore these studies and continue to create research that tries to prove that there are connections or correlations between genes and racial populations. Now, why is that? Right? If science merely moves along by integrating new evidence and data and adjusting our hypotheses, then why haven't scientists abandoned this pursuit of race? And what I argue is that the reason why we haven't seen this transition is that many scientists believe that race is real and that it just simply requires the right methodology to be able to prove at a genetic or biological level that race is something that actually comes from nature, if you will, and is not really socially constructed. That's what the book is trying to talk about, right? So, yeah, I'm sure there are scientists who might call in who might be upset about that, but I think we have to critically interrogate the persistent commitment to thinking in racial terms by scientists despite the overwhelming evidence showing you cannot actually study human groups and assume that they lump into very clean racial categories.
And is this, I'm sitting like, I will circle back around to this, but I'm sitting with one of the more recent versions of that return to this same question just from the New York Times from 2 days ago. And we'll get there, but is this sort of compulsion to return to this question? Is it unique to Western society? Is it unique, or is this across the board in terms of scientists that we see? I mean, how culturally or societally unique is this phenomena?
Yeah, I don't like that question because what it does is it downplays the very specific American European history that has been one shaped by race as an organizing concept. I mean, if you look at the modern Western world, so the expansion of Europe into West Africa and to North and South America, and then the subsequent enslavement and dispossession of Africans and Native American populations, we're talking about a history that's driven by race, and specifically race that favors Protestant Western Europeans, and that our society, particularly in the United States, has been organized around this principle. Okay, and our society continues to be organized around this principle, and the legislative history of this nation in particular, from the 13th Amendment all the way into our contemporary political landscape, makes it painfully obvious that race continues to orient how we think and operate as a society. Now, being that being the case, we should not be surprised then that our science, and there are a few scientists that continue to think about human diversity in racial terms. If our society values race as an organizing principle, that then will be reflected within our science. And this gets to my point that I started with, which is to say, scientists are not impervious to social historical influences, right? And if we have researchers like David Reich and others who continue to look at the genetic basis for race, it is because we live in a society that continues to be organized as race as an organizing principle, right? So the idea that somehow scientists are working in a vacuum and are not influenced by culture or belief of the past is simply erroneous. It doesn't actually describe the work that scientists really do. I mean, David Reich is a social human being like everyone else, and he reads the news, he understands history, so surely he's going to be influenced by this larger legacy. Now, the work that I do as a historian and a scholar, both of religion and intellectual history, is to say, look, the positions that scientists hold, the beliefs that they hold, the stakes that they map out, they have a history to them. And we can actually do better science when we understand that there's a history to the claims and the research projects that we take up. And that if federal tax dollars and private money are being invested to study race with some illusion of trying to help transform society, I think those who potentially stand to benefit or not from those research technologies have to weigh in on the histories that shape the work of the scientists. And so this is what my book is trying to at least open up as a conversation.
Let's talk about some of those priors, because in your introduction, you talk about the Spencer Wells. and who developed the standard interpretation of human evolution and migration. Tell us what that is, and then let's uncover, I guess, the legacy ideas that help formulate that.
Sure. So in its simplest form, what Spencer Wells is doing post 2000, which is the moment where geneticists are able to look at the genetic diversity across human groups, and we're able to trace the Y chromosome lineage, to be able to find that humans share genetic ancestry that can be traced back to Africa, right? And that this then, Spencer Wells is doing is trying to narrate a story of migration out of Africa into Australia and then into other parts of the world. And genetically, this has been the narrative that has carried the day, if you will, within the ways in which we think about human population emergence and dispersal. Okay, and it proceeds on a model of dispersal and replacement in that at its core, if we think about it, it involves a population that is collected in Africa and then a small version of them move to another region in the world, then create a kind of population diversity, and then a small group of them move to another region of the world. And this continues all the way into the Americas. And what's interesting about that model is that there are some philosophical assumptions behind it. Part of those assumptions involve when populations coalesce and come together, they generate a kind of homogeneous set of traits that then when a member or a small group break apart from that larger group, those traits get carried over to some degree into the creation of a new population. And then there's another sort of body of collection of humans that then a small group breaks apart and disperses. And it's that dispersal and movement that allows for geneticists to talk about the sort of common shared human ancestry. But there's a flaw to this way of thinking. And that is, firstly, it tends to create a narrative where we imagine that the populations that were left were static, that they didn't change biologically, that they remained genetically what they were, and therefore the Africans and the Aboriginals and the Europeans and the Asians, they are roughly sort of kind of clear homogeneous groups that are genetically similar. Well, we know from contemporary genetic research there's a tremendous amount of genetic diversity in Africa alone. It's one of the most genetically diverse places in the world because of all the amount of genetic recombination that's taken place over multiple generations. We also know with recent ancestral research, populations in Africa continue to move to and from the Middle East into Europe and back into Africa, creating a kind of continuous process of genetic mixture and diversity, so much so that it becomes very difficult to even talk about Africa as a stable genetic population. And this same is true for populations in Australia, populations in Europe and Asia, and in North America, right? But it is conceptually clean and easy to imagine human diversity in terms of a few sort of pure or homogeneous genetic populations, right? Now, what I've done in my book then is to think about historical precedents where this form of thinking has happened before Spencer Wells. And when we tell that story, that involves a larger historical arc that you can trace back to the early church, and you can trace to the formation of early modern biology, where coming out of what I call Christian intellectual history, which describes a set of ideas and philosophies and reasoning strategies that were part of Christian thinking that influence the way ethnologists and early natural historians, and these are people who we would call sort of contemporary scientists, the way that they studied the natural world. And these Christian assumptions brought with them ideas about population emergence and dispersal. We often forget Christianity is not just a religion about heaven and earth and salvation. It's also a religion that has a lot of ideas about where populations emerge and where they disperse. And this is actually not unique to Christianity. All of the Abrahamic faith traditions, which includes Judaism and Islam, share the story of Noah, for example, which is a story that explains the emergence of an original population that are descendants of Adam, and that population then disperses, God is upset with human groups and chooses a select few to be saved. This is sort of Noah and his sons. The human populations that are on the globe are wiped out through a global sort of deluge catastrophe. And then Noah's sons disembark on the ark, and Shem, Ham, and Japheth then literally repopulate the earth, giving us Asia, Europe, and Africa. If you look in the 9th century and the 6th century, you begin to see the emergence of this story being used to talk about the continental ancestries of human groups. Isidore Seville is an encyclopedist in Spain who creates these original maps called TO maps, and these maps are a division of the world into three different quadrants, or three different circles, or sections, rather. And these sections have Asia, Europe, and Africa, but then also written up below them are the names of Noah's three sons, and that these maps get reproduced from the 6th century all the way up until as late as the 13th century. And they're being dispersed and used all throughout Europe to imagine the kind of interconnection of all the racial groups, but more importantly, create a kind of intellectual model for thinking about human diversity from a common ancestor and then the emergence of subsequent groups. So when we think about that, and then we then think about the conceptual models that geneticists are using that involve population emergence, population dispersal, and eventually population replacement, there are clear conceptual lineages at work here. It is not, Spencer Wells is not sort of creating ex nihilo, a model of thinking about humans descending from a common ancestor. He is standing within an intellectual trajectory that is deeply connected to Christian Western thinking about race and human emergence. And my book is trying to unpack that story.
Now, that is known, and correct me if I'm wrong, as monogenism.
Monogenism, yes.
Okay, monogenism. And so the argument is that the framework for that monogenism is a function of sort of, I guess, archetypal, Judeo-Christian stories, essentially. And so now is the idea that there's really no way of testing either that story of monogenism, or is it that we shouldn't even be, or there's no testing of the concept of monogenism as opposed to polygenism?
Yes, you're right. I'm arguing that there is a kind of intellectual lineage that starts with a very kind of specific theological story about human diversity that then gets translated into what we could say a secular or scientific story that still carries with it those earlier Christian elements. Yes, I'm surely saying that. But to your question, though, which, if I can phrase it a little differently, what you're asking is, well, just because it comes from Christianity, does that mean that that isn't true? Right? Is what the geneticists are finding in the genome, which seems to suggest that there's evidence of common ancestry, does that mean that common ancestry is merely a myth or an illusion? If I hear you correctly, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I mean, that's a cleaner way of stating it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that I have trouble sure. buying, but the idea that maybe there was a big family and they all went to different parts of the world. Maybe there were three of them, I mean, that to me, is that testable? Has that been tested? Maybe there was a Noah's Ark. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to say, and this gets me back to how I started, what I'm trying to say is that science proceeds on cultural history and it is informed by questions of belief. Okay. And what I'm really trying to argue is not dispute necessarily if common human ancestry is real or not. I'm asking a different question, which is, why do we continue to need this idea? And is it an innate idea that all humans have in all places? Or is it an idea that is useful socially, politically, and scientifically, right? And that therefore the things that we supposedly discover or study in the lab, how much of that is actually a result of our own creation, right? That we're creating the genetic story that link us together in this kind of common human framework because we value common human ancestry. One could imagine, for example, a different type of social cosmology where common human ancestry isn't necessarily the guiding framework for thinking about human diversity. And in fact, some population geneticists who are beginning to really take seriously the kind of complexity of ancient DNA and our ancient hominid ancestors, this includes the Neanderthals, the Denisovans, the Red Deer people, populations that we didn't really know how genetically diverse they were until about 8 years ago with the first Neanderthal genome sequencing. What we're beginning to realize is that there's so much genetic complexity taking place in among our ancient ancestors, and even among sort of the first populations that would be anatomically modern, that sometimes it's not necessarily useful to talk about that diversity as being derived from a common single ancestor. There might be another interpretive framework that could be more useful for talking about that diversity. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not all linked biologically. It just means shifting the conversation a bit. Now, to your question, if I can get it out a more specific way, what I'm trying to get us to realize is that science has not fully extricated itself from the kind of religious patterning of its past, and that particularly in the West, we've inherited certain ideas and beliefs that have become deeply integrated into our political life, deeply integrated into our scientific life, and that this is not necessarily a bad thing. The point of raising our awareness of this is to say, look, if there is this sort of remnant of Christian thinking in the way in which biologists think about race, we need to firstly look at this with kind of unflinching courage and say, fine, this may be happening, and then question the degree to which is this useful or not? Are we creating scientific projects that actually help us understand the complexity of human life? Or could it be that race thinking within biology and genetics, and a lot of my colleagues actually would think this, doesn't actually help us understand the complexity of social life? Just to give you just an example. A few years ago, there was a research study done by the Sigma Consortium, which is a collection of geneticists who are working in Latin America and Mexico, and they are supported by the research of Carlos Slim, who is one of the world's most wealthiest men. And this consortium is looking to try to understand the genetic basis of diseases that specifically afflict Latin Americans and Mexican populations. And one of the things that the consortium is interested in is type 2 diabetes. Now, type 2 diabetes is a sort of a chronic disease that actually takes place later in life. It's not a disease like type 1 diabetes, which is actually inherited. Type 2 diabetes, potentially given one's diet and sort of nutrition, one can develop type 2 diabetes over one's lifespan. In any case, the researchers are still interested in perhaps trying to understand why Mexican populations might have elevated risk of type 2 diabetes. As a result of our sequencing the Neanderthal genome, we've learned that apparently Neanderthals have a risk allele that is somewhat associated with type 2 diabetes among them as a species, but then also potentially within humans who intermated with them. And as it turns out, there's a specific risk allele that appears in Mexican populations that increases their chances of getting type 2 diabetes by 50%. Okay? Now, in order for this story to work, what we have to imagine is that an allele that gets introduced into the human population around 30,000 years ago has traveled through Europe and Asia, has made its way across the Bering Strait into North America and into South America, and then has been in the bodies of native populations, and then has then led to being within Mexican groups, right? And that this gene has traveled this 30,000 years and is responsible for elevated risk for type 2 diabetes. Now, there are problems with this story. Firstly, we know that type 2 diabetes can be corrected or prevented through the measures I've already mentioned, social measures, right? Access to nutrition, diet, health care, these sorts of things. Access to preventative drugs and therapies. Preventative treatment from physicians. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to look for a gene for a disease that we know can be corrected by social causes, right? But secondly, if we actually think about this scientifically, there are some other flaws, because in order for this gene to be responsible for this risk, we would have to assume that it would have to be in Native American populations in 5,000 years ago. And working with some colleagues of mine who actually specifically study this, and my colleague Deborah Bolnick, who is at UT Austin, we've actually looked at Native American populations some 5,000 years ago. And what we've actually found is that, yes, this risk allele is present, but the biomarkers for type 2 diabetes are not really prevalent. So what this means is that, yes, the gene is there, and it's actually there in a fairly high frequency, a higher frequency than what we find in current Mexican populations. But we don't actually find the biomarkers for disease. But in present Mexican groups, what we find instead is that the gene is there, but in a lower frequency, but type 2 diabetes is all over the place. So what this says is that the environment is what is actually causing this disease, not a kind of visualization or conceptualization of race and genetics that might be explaining this disease.
But couldn't it be, I mean, and I'm, you know, but couldn't it be that there is simply a higher risk that is there that then interacts with the context of diet or of changes in the environment or whatever, something outside, cultural things that have changed, so that the interplay between the genetics and the context outside of the environment, broadly speaking, that dynamic changes. So you 5,000 years ago, you have less of a concentration, or you have more of a concentration of that gene. You have less indication that type 2 diabetes is a problem, but the mere existence of that gene in any quantity mixed with, an increase in eating of corn. I'm just guessing, but I would imagine scientists go in and they say, we're going to control for these variables. And is it not a worthy pursuit, generally speaking, to say, does the presence of a gene increase the possibility based upon environmental factors? Or are you saying that if environmental factors are playing 75% to 80% or 90% of the role, then it's the genetic component is largely irrelevant?
No, firstly, genes only ever operate in a social environment. Period, right? Genes are in humans, and humans exist within a social environment, and a political environment, and an economic one, right? And so that if we're going to talk about the effect that a gene may or may not be doing, scientists, you need to be responsible for thinking about the actual social political environment under which that gene is doing something, right? And so in that sense, what we need to be doing is not, I'm not saying that there may not be a risk here. What I'm saying, however, is that there's a narrative to be told about what that risk might actually be, right? It's not simply the case that if the gene is present, we should expect it to necessarily manifest in disease. As it turns out, if you're going to think about, well, why might Native American and Mexican populations be at an elevated risk for type 2 diabetes, we have to talk about colonization. We have to talk about the dispossession of land, and therefore the changing of foodways that Native American populations underwent. We have to talk about the stress factors involved with experiencing racial genocide and what that actually means in terms of the ancestors of those people who survived those genocidal political projects. And then we also have to talk about the transition in the lifestyle and the diets and the social environment of current Mexican populations, both in Mexico as well as those who are moving to the United States. These are messy details that often geneticists or biologists do want to control for, but I think it flattens the complexity of the story. It says simply that colonization and legacy of racism, these things do have an effect on the bodies of people, and it also elevates their risk for disease and illness. And this is part of the story that many scientists don't want to talk about, right? And if you actually look at the study of the Sigma Consortium, they mentioned, yes, this could be one factor among many in terms of trying to explain type 2 diabetes. But if we think about the larger historical narrative, that part isn't there, the actual narrative of dispossession and what this does to human bodies. So what I'm trying to say, and you did say this in your initial response, it's a complex story in that we need to be thinking about genetics and biology and society as always interrelated with one another. And in the case of type 2 diabetes, it just turns out that you can think about the history of the disease without knowledge, really, of its genetics. I mean, we've already known from countless studies done by public health researchers, like my colleague Claudia Schaffen, who's at York University in Canada, who's been a leading expert on looking at the development of type 2 diabetes in particular. We know that actually these are diseases that can be understood and change. And this is a larger point. Why are we studying this to begin with? It's about social change. It's about making people better. And if we can do that without looking at the genes, if we can do that by looking at, like I've mentioned, diet, exercise, access to health care, these social political measures, that is the thing that we should be focusing on, right?
I see. So to a certain extent, this is a story of the guy who shows up at the job site with a hammer, and so everything gets hammered. And, well, yeah, in some instances, a saw is actually going to work better. Well, if you give me enough time with a hammer, I could break that 2x4. It's that
exactly. Okay. Yes, and this is my larger point, which is all of this gets set into motion because of a commitment to thinking in racial terms, right? If we suspend this, I think, obsessive commitment to thinking about the connections that might be between genetics and race, if we can just suspend that commitment and then step away from it, I think it allows us a larger lens to imagine why certain groups are unhealthy and why certain groups are at risk. I didn't mention this, but not every Mexican population, not every person who's defined as Mexican in this study has this risk allele, which is to say that the even concept of Mexican or Latin American, these categories are not necessarily the best way of organizing groups to begin with, right? And so, yes, you're right, it's the wrong tool. And in many ways, there's a bit of a kind of almost dogmatic commitment of many geneticists to think really quickly in racial terms and ignore all the counterfactual evidence, all the countless studies that have actually shown there really are not strong correlations, if any at all, between race and genetics. This data gets ignored, right? And if science is at its best, an ability to revise one's hypotheses, to think differently about social causes, or to think differently about the biological causes for certain diseases and illnesses, it's remarkable to think about how this hasn't happened when it comes to race. And that, like you said, there's a kind of an imagination that says, well, if we just get the right methodology or with the right resources or with the right funding or with the right technology, soon we'll be able to crack this code. And scientists have been saying this certainly since the 1950s, right? So this has been a commitment that has been going on for a really long time that has often ignored evidence that is showing at every step of the way these associations don't work.
And so if I understand the broader argument is that the part of this, it seems to me, is driven by the idea of like, I'm a geneticist and I want to get in the game. Lawyers do the same thing, except for they move through society and they can legalize a lot more of our society, that geneticists want to get into the game. And they are aided by a legacy of a formulation that has, thousands years of lineage in Western thought that compels them to look for that also aids in that compulsion, I guess.
Yes, I think it's a very fair. I think it's a fair way of characterizing it, and it's interesting. You also put in, you mentioned or alluded to the idea of there being incentives, which is another important part of this story. I mean, if you think about the amount of financial investment from the NIH just alone into looking at the genetic basis for name whatever X disease in specific populations, particularly minority populations in the U.S., we're talking about millions of dollars that are coming from taxpayers and from the federal government trying to find these connections. And of course, you create then an incentive for geneticists who will stake their career on trying to find correlations between genes and race, or race, genes, and disease. And I think this reflects in a kind of paradoxical way. On the one hand, some of this effort is driven by what we might call somewhat benevolent government thinking on trying to address health disparities that afflict minority populations. and trying to close the gap between black-white health disparities. And this is something that my colleague Stephen Epstein has written about in his book Inclusion, which talks about how with the revitalization of the NIH Act in the 1990s under Bill Clinton, what you begin to see is a transition where clinical trial research is specifically looking at women and minority populations to be able to create drug therapies that specifically benefit them, right? And that then this, what this does is it's driven by social, kind of at the very surface level at least, social change, right? But what ends up happening is that there's a market component to this as well, because if we're talking about drug therapies that are going to change society, those drugs have to be purchased and they have to be sold. And we do live in a society where healthcare is driven by a profit margin. And so there is cost associated with this, but there's also profit to be made. And what ends up happening over time is that race gets reified as a social problem to be solved through drug intervention and therapies. And then you can get, following through, geneticists and biologists who are committing their career on trying to figure out the sort of racial components that might be involved and name whatever disease you're interested in, right? And so my colleague Jonathan Kahn's book on Bidal is a great example of how Bidal gets sort of patented as kind of one of the first race-specific drugs in the wake of this kind of transition to looking at minorities, and it's a drug designed for heart disease in African Americans. And so it's a complex story of government actors trying to create social change, but then market calculations about the profit to be made through such interventions, and then the careers of scientists who are also being incentivized to look for the racial basis to disease and illness. And this, again, gets back to my larger point, which I began with. Scientists don't do their work in a political social vacuum. And so when they pursue certain questions, particularly questions around race, I think we all have to step back and think about the larger social political environment under which these questions are being asked. And when you do that, you can begin to see these larger associations that are often hidden if we're only looking at the research.
So let's let's come back to that that David Reich piece. And you know, this is there's been a lot of talk of Charles Murray back in the news, and I think we can expand the cadre of people who are sort of addressing this stuff. But Reich wrote a piece in the Times, I guess it was a month ago, not in April 23rd, but March 23rd. And he argues here, and this, again, in some ways fulfills your thesis, but he's arguing that that over the years, this consensus of that there was that among human populations, there are no differences large enough to support the concept of biological race. This consensus has morphed, he writes, seemingly without question, into an orthodoxy. The orthodoxy maintains that the average genetic differences among people grouped according to today's racial terms are so trivial that when it comes to any meaningful biological traits, that those differences can be ignored. I mean, that's what you're arguing, except for the fact that the orthodoxy has really been in existence for thousands of years until we actually had the hard science to determine that, like, that is the case, that these differences are not meaningful, is really what it comes down to. Meaningful in the pursuit of attempting to make life better or to for people. And but he goes on to say that there are recent genetic studies that have demonstrated differences across populations in terms of skin color, in terms of body dimensions and susceptibility to diseases. And he's very worried that well-meaning people, maybe like yourself and maybe like myself, are missing the ball here. I mean, just give me your sense of how you contextualize this argument specifically or more generally, I guess, but wait, I get what you're saying, but wait a second. Is this just more like fodder for your thesis?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways to get at that. I mean, as you may know, David Reich's book has been roundly critiqued by biologists and geneticists and social scientists in a variety of venues. challenging his work, and these are also challenges that are coming from geneticists who actually show, in fact, actually the data doesn't pan out this way, and that these correlations that he's alluding to are actually false, and that there really is not any conclusion or consensus among geneticists about there being a genetic basis to race. So that's what has to just be said in general. I think what we have to think about what Reich is really doing with that particular piece and the marketing of the book and the type of national attention it's gotten, we're talking about a rhetorical war, really. We're talking about a conflict over who has the authority to talk about science and to talk about race. And that this is what Reich is trying to do. He's trying to, through the rhetoric of thinking about the scientist as the person who possesses truth, and that those on the other side are somehow driven by politics and ideology or orthodoxy, it's about trying to have control over language. And if you think really about it, the orthodoxy, if you think about my own book, the orthodoxy has always been on the other side, right?
Right.
Which is to say it's the scientists themselves who are being shaped by a religious intellectual history that they are unwilling to recognize and acknowledge, in large part because contemporary definitions of science, we have relieved scientists of having to account for the history of the tools and the concepts they use to do their work, right? We have relieved them of that. And in many ways, Reich sounds really similar to the new atheist, and he sounds very similar to evolutionary biologists at the end of the 19th century who are following in the wake of Darwin and are trying to control the intellectual market, if you will, of who can be a proper biologist and how and why it is that Darwinian evolution needs to drive the ways in which biology organizes itself. And in making these sort of public claims, right, biologists at the end of the 19th century were able to identify in their minds those who were sort of from the past, whose ideas were not consistent with the cutting-edge truth that stands independent of sort of politics and time. In a similar way, we can see Reich trying to corner the kind of rhetorical market of who has the power of talking about scientific research at the level of genetic racial differences. And so I think we have to acknowledge that. And I think just another point that I want to say, specifically with this criticism of social constructionists, right? It is not the case that social constructionists deny the truth of science. Social constructionists have actually arrived at their positions that race is socially constructed as a result of the research of scientists.
Right.
So people like Richard Lewontin and others who have actually shown genetically these correlations don't work, right? And we need better science. And I think that often gets lost in these type of simplified description of what social constructionists really are. They're people who are very much informed by the science, and they are very much informed by the history of scientific thinking about race. And that many of these social constructionists are proper geneticists, right? And, you know, people who have been devoted their own careers to thinking about why and how it is that human groups or even other species can't be lumped in clear biological cleavages, and specifically populations, human populations can't be lumped according to race. One finer point to kind of put on this is that, and this is part of the conversation that I think we need to have more of, we have to recognize that social policies, political and racial discrimination, exposure to environmental toxins, these are all social political factors that have effects on our biology. And if certain populations are subjected to political, social, and economic forms of risk and harm over multiple generations, we should imagine that their descendants will express certain types of disposition to illness and disease. Now, does this mean that since the beginning of time, those people were programmed by God or nature to be predisposed to disease? No, of course not. No one would actually argue that. But what we should be thinking about instead are, let's document the social political moment in which a certain group or population, either through dispossession of land of the Native Americans and the disruption of their foodways, how that created types of biological risks that get expressed in their bodies, right? So we could think, if we want to use the term race, which I don't think is exactly the best tool always to think about, but even if we did for the sake of argument, using it as a heuristic, right? If we wanted to say, fine, use the concept Native American to think about what types of risks Native American populations might have. I think we would have to use it in a way that's aware of, firstly, it's a simply a provisional tool for talking about a group of people at a specific historical period of time to diagnose the kind of social political factors that subjected those groups, defining those terms, to specific types of diseases or specific types of factors that elevate their likelihood of getting disease. That, I think, is a much more creative way of thinking about race, because it allows you to talk about the social context without condemning those groups to being sort of determined by their biology. In fact, what we can say is, look, social political environment has a tremendous amount of effect on our health, and it's something that we carry with us and our children carry with them.
So in many respects, I mean, this is, there's an interdisciplinary battle going on here. And on one, you know, to go back to my crude construction analogy, the guy who shows up with the hammer, in being a good carpenter, as far as that hammer goes, should know, you know, part of being a good carpenter is not to just start banging the 2x4 in the middle with the hopes of breaking it. You wait for the nails, essentially. This is, I mean, it's also interesting to me, too, that when you bring up the new atheist, because there's a quality of essentially trying to use the authority that comes from science, the discipline, I guess, of genetics is wielded in the same way that rationality is for the new atheists in a similar way. This is just attempt to position themselves as the one true keeper of the truth, even when they may be denying their own sort of, I guess, incursions upon, that from which they get their basis of their truth.
What's interesting is that the new atheists are concerned that in this sort of current administration, where there is an assault on science and there's an assault on reason, the new atheists are concerned that those who critique science are somehow undermining rationality. And in a similar rhetorical way, you can see that David Reich is actually seizing upon this cultural moment by saying those who critique genetics, even those who might be from the left, are actually threatening sort of the truth, threatening the kind of power and veracity and importance of science and with society. David Reich is a very brilliant man and understands the power of language and rhetoric. And if you think about the positioning of the book in this current moment, it's set up in such a way that the critics of this type of scientific reasoning get seen as science deniers in some sort, right? Which is a type of rhetorical strategy that's being used all across the board to talk about climate science, to talk about a variety of things. And so I think this needs to be part of how we are thinking about the timing of this book's release, but then also the alliances that Reich has, I believe, with the new atheists, the Sam Harrises of the world, for example, who are also doubling down on the need to protect rationality. But in fact, what we're really talking about are people who are completely committed to the scientific method and surely are committed to reasoning, but say, look, part of what it is to be a rational, historical, embodied person is to question the reasoning that we use and to question the assumptions that are built into our scientific projects, and that if we just simply take for granted these assumptions, we are committing ourselves to a type of dogmatism, which denies the ability to challenge truth, to challenge the research that we pursue. I think that's the danger, really. The danger is really uncritically accepting these genetic studies as if they are the truth. What we need to be doing is having a more robust conversation that, frankly, gets us over our gene obsession and gets us to thinking about social history, political environments, these things that actually shape us.
Let me just clarify, too. It doesn't seem like that the argument is to question the validity of the genetic studies, but rather their prominence in their determination of what is the perceived problem or issue.
Well, it
seems to me that there isn't a questioning necessarily of the genetic studies, but rather a questioning of the prominence that certain people place, that you know, give them in the context of a broader question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if I understand you correctly, it's part of at least what I'm trying to say is that there are many different ways to think about health risk and to think about why humans might vary.
Right.
And genetics might be a part of that story. But we often ignore that there are other factors that are not immediately tied to genes, or if they are, they are at the very least centered more around things that actually augment genes or things that actually affect us in our sort of adult lifetime that might be as important. And so part of it is sort of recognizing that we do, in fact, privilege genes for
right.
thinking about
exactly.
human diversity. And then asking, why do we privilege genes? Is this something that's innate within human groups? This is a privilege genetics? And obviously, it sounds like a ridiculous question, but it's a question that has to be raised, and only because it allows you to then think about, well, historically, can we think about previous moments in time where an obsession with genetics played out in ways that we can talk about, right? Which we can think about the eugenics
yes.
movement, clearly. We can think about social Darwinism at the end of the 19th century. Oh, wait a minute. There's a social history to our current cultural political moment that is one colored by an obsession with thinking in terms of genetics. I think that is part of what I'm trying to do in the book, is to bring our awareness to the histories behind our questions, and that these questions are shaped by specific social legacies that are unique to Europe and unique to the United States, and that when we then are in a moment where geneticists are trying to sort of stake their claim over our social imagination about race, it's worth then pushing back and saying, yeah, but there are other ways to think about human diversity, and that we don't need to be locked into this paradigm of obsessing over our genetic origins in some ways.
It's a fascinating book. Terrence Keel, Associate Professor of History and Black Studies, University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you so much for joining us. It's Divine Variations, How Christian Thought Became Racial Science. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yep, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, folks. I got to say, he is that endeavor far more polite than what I would say is just they're just trying to make a buck. Right? I mean, I think like this is the story of like what we know about genes, you know, that we've learned over the past several decades is, you know, more or less true. And the societal factors that we see every day and are really have a much bigger role, that doesn't get you the spread in the New York Times magazine. That's the problem.
Well, here's the counterpoint.
Scientific data can't be racist.
Scientific data cannot be racist. No. But when we start to do a podcast about it, or when we write a piece or a book, or we put it in, we go on tour, then it can be. We can take that data and completely weaponize it immediately.
I mean, you can collect data based on faulty racial premises, and that is technically scientific data that other people could like observe and reproduce, but it's fundamentally nonsense. Like,
right. I mean, that's
Sam
the thing.
Sam Harris opens his mouth, it could be racist.
And it's almost like sad that Terrence Keel has to know who Sam Harris is. That to me is sad.
It's sad that we have to know who
yeah,
he is,
I know.
Let alone
it
Terrence
is.
Keel.
But I contend, and I think maybe part of the reason why it is you do get this piece in the Sunday Review, how genetics is changing our understanding of race, is because of the intellectual sort of history that we have and the framework that sets it up. But I'm quite convinced that if this didn't sell any books, he wouldn't bother.
No, not at all. Although the only thing I find interesting about his piece is that he was significantly more careful than any of these other characters, and actually did a Q&A follow-up where he was like, you got to remember, you can't think in terms of group averages. So even if this stuff, like he covered his tracks a lot more. And the reason that this whole debate and argument started with Harris and Klein again is that Harris tweeted this piece at Klein and was like, oh, you know, PC police, you should be on the patrol. And Ezra responded by writing that great takedown of Harris, right, which he began with by like, I wasn't really bothered by the David Reich piece, which is hysterical because David Reich, for better and for worse, and I tend to think for worse, but for what it's worth, did what Harris is claiming, and it caused barely any uproar. So exactly, they're like, the great irony is that the Reich piece didn't generate any of this.
If you've got to, if you have to tweet at people to alert the PC police, maybe there's been no crime.
Yeah, maybe, right? We were maybe slacking. Like, yeah. Through, oh, thanks for calling that in. We were having donuts and totally missed the massive eugenics argument in the Sunday Times. Thank you, yeah, Sam Harris. Yeah,
you know what the subtext of that tweet is? Like, I need a podcast 2 weeks from now, and if you don't give me a reaction, I'm not going to have anything to talk about.
You know, the other history I love, I just want to tag onto this really briefly, is that Stephen Jay Gould wrote an amazing book on this called The Mismeasure of Man, and there was a report in 2011 in the New York Times that his research had been debunked significantly. Now, it came out in 2014, there was, you know, further research, and that's complicated, and it's not as simple as Gould got it wrong, and his book is bigger than just this research. It's really a social history of metrics used to justify racism. It's in a similar vein. The guy who wrote the 2011 takedown of Stephen Jay Gould is a guy named Nicholas Wade, who wrote a book in 2014 called Troubled Inheritance, which is a racist book, which David Reich used in his column as an example of what not to do with findings in genetic research. Hmm. So it's just, it's like, even in that case, it's like, nobody wants to think historically, just even in terms of the context of covering their own tracks journalistically, you know?
But the amazing thing about this is as minimalist as Reich is trying to be about these, it's still overblown.
Yep.
Because I also think that like there is a fascination with genetics as being like that, this is the key. Like, this is all the key that you need. You just need to bring this in. You put it in the locker.
Dude,
and then
Trump even says it. I mean, just think of where that comes from. I mean, this was not a family that he grew up in that was like contemplating. They weren't like sitting down as a family and reading, you know, nature together. But somewhere along the line, he heard that certain people had better genetics than others.
Well,
and I wonder
that's
where
the
that
other
came
thing.
From.
There, I mean, then there's the all the. It's not just. I'm saying there's a sci-fi quality to it. I think for your average person, there's also definitely like you can weaponize this stuff because if genes are determinant, then if I am a son of a millionaire or a billionaire, then guess what? I deserve it because I got the genes. I mean, that is the sort of the ultimate libertarian argument, isn't it? Like at the end of the day,
hierarchies are natural.
Are natural.
That's
exactly.
The bell curve.
They think they're Thomas Jefferson.
The bell curve. Yeah, well, the bell curve specifically cites Thomas Jefferson as well as the Hindu caste system. And Richard Lynn, who's much more overt, wrote The Global Bell Curve because this stuff is spreading across Europe as well. And it's just naturalizing hierarchies and racism. It's the same game.
I mean, if I were Professor Keel, I'd be pissed that I still have to even be arguing this point.
Oh, my God.
Because this stuff seems pretty discredited. And he did it without calling anyone a racist, which I probably would. Like,
no,
a lot of this stuff boils down to racism.
I think what the book does is it provides some type of like, I think my guess is that, you know, we're supposed to come to that conclusion on our own because the framework is there.
I came to that conclusion on my own because I have really good genes.
You know, spelling that out sounds somewhat invidious, and we don't really have time to clean up the mess.
Oh, God. All right. Look, we're going to take a break.
Finally found a use for Sam Harris.
Yeah, these are... My God. Folks, this program relies on its members to sustain itself. You become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Costs you dimes a day. Dimes a day to become a member and support this program. And when you do so, you support the free show so that we can have interviews with folks like Terrence Keel, or, you know, who else did we have this? What day is today? I get Rachel Hyman yesterday. And others. And when you do become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, we say thank you by giving you hours of extra content a week. So maybe you know, I don't want to hear Sam do the news on Monday. I want to just go to the fun half where they make fun of whoever it is. You know,
lots of people
made fun of Sam Harris. Or Sam, not Harris. Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson.
Jordan Peterson.
Okay. So say that they
or like I'm only interested in hearing people laugh at Donald Trump attempt to hold his wife's hand and her swatting it away.
By the way, I had a new bit I was thinking of Jordan Peterson doing a commentary over the Elliot Rodgers video.
Oh my God.
I mean, he is a perfect gentleman.
Let's save that for the fun half. But folks, but if you do want the fun half and you can't, you don't have the financial means to do it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Also, today is Wednesday, April 25th, and that means that you have 5 days left to buy your justcoffee.coop coffee at 30% discount. You don't even need to use a coupon code. Just go there, buy it. You can buy a 5-pound bag, you can buy like a 2-pound bag, like a 1-pound bag. Try your different types of coffee so that you're not experimenting at the full price. Shipping is also free. Last night was Tuesday night. That means that it was TMBS night. And on that show, Corey Pine was here to talk about his new book.
Live, Work, 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 Die, Journey into the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley.
Jesus.
And we also
put all that on the cover?
They did. It's actually a really well-done cover, and it's already probably outsold your book, so...
Well, I don't know about that.
I have no idea. How well did your book sell?
Fubar did pretty well.
You got actually a book? I did not know that.
Well, I mean, it was a while ago.
That's what we call the fadeaway in the biz.
We should talk. I need book advice.
So. Probably not the best place for
we also
to get that book advice.
An incredible
Here's my advice. Don't.
Oh, no.
Leck has really good genes for drops.
Make a good cover. That's the important thing. Good cover.
And H-Bomber guy there's this terrifying clip.
All right, well, leave some to the imagination.
There's a ton to the imagination.
You don't have to, like,
Peter Thiel calls in.
Yeah. Peter Thiel calls in.
Okay, yeah, keep it below the knee, if you know what I'm saying.
No, not really.
Yeah, leave some to the imagination.
Oh, that's a very antiquated reference.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, Foster Freeze.
Check out Antifada at patreon.com/antifada.
Yes, we got a new episode dropping today.
See, that's the way you do it. All right, we got to take a quick break. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.